Good morning. I'm Teresa Lamb, and I am grateful to be in Al-Anon. I'm grateful that I don't have to live like I used to live. I'm grateful that I don't have to be like I used to be. I'm grateful for the sunshine. Man, I needed that. I was really happy this morning to wake up and see that sunlight. It feels so good. Thank you for asking me to be here. This is a very special place. It's a very a place that provokes a love for the fellowship, to get to be with people who are striving, continuing to strive for recovery in their lives. I remember that was one of the first things that impressed me about being in meetings of recovery. The idea, everybody was there looking for a way out. I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, not because I wanted to be there, but because I didn't know anything else to do. I had tried everything else, I thought. And I went there, and I don't remember what they said that night, but I knew that I was in a place with people like me for the very first time. I don't know why I didn't know how to live. I had a mom and a dad that loved me, a brother and a sister, you know, the little family unit. We weren't real connected with other family people, so I guess in many ways I was kind of isolated. We didn't interact with other family members a whole lot. So it was just this little family unit with mom enmeshed with dad. They were madly in love with each other. They were very young. And so I kind of grew up with this Prince Charming sort of thing going on, you know? You grow up, you find your Prince Charming, you get married, and you live happily ever after in a little house with a white picket fence and two cats in the yard and the 2 point however many kids, and life is good, right? But then there's alcoholism. and it's shocking. It's not what I expected, and I actually became profoundly disappointed with my life. When I grew up and found my Prince Charming, he turned out to be a drunken frog. I kissed him. He did not transform like he was supposed to do. I was a kid. I was 17 years old when I met him. I went to work at my first full-time job, and there he was, handsome. He walked up to me and took my hand to see if I was wearing a wedding ring. I was 17 years old the Monday after I graduated from high school. And he was 10 years older than me, and he was married, had two kids. All that went right over my head. I had no concept. I was going to marry that man. I knew right away I was going to marry him. And I did. I married him in spite of everything, all of that. He was separated from his wife. He, and he was this pitiful creature. And you know what I was going to do. I mean, I was Al-Anonic. I didn't know it, but I was Al-Anonic. And so what was I going to do? I was going to save him. I was going to rescue him. I was going to love him so much that he wasn't going to be unhappy anymore. And he was going to overcome all those tragic things that had happened to him. His dad, you know, was mean to him, and his brother committed suicide, and his cousin committed suicide, and he had all this, you know, he had this mean old wife, and you know, all these things. And I was going to fix all that by loving him enough. And as the book about Lois Wilson, who founded Al-Anon, tells you, love is not enough. Love is not enough. But I thought it was, because I thought that fairy tale stuff was real. And I thought that Richard Gere was going to come take me down off the fire escape or the factory floor, and it was going to be okay. And it wasn't okay. My daddy drank. He was an alcoholic. He was a funny, sweet, handsome guy. He was not mean. There wasn't violence in our home. He drank beer and he fell asleep on the couch. Wrecked the car a couple times. Had to go with my mom to get him when I was a teenager. And, you know, back then they'd call you. Your husband has run over the curb here. You can come pick him up and take him home. So I went with her and we drove the cars back, that kind of thing. And he was my hero. And I wanted somebody just like him. I wanted to be just like him. My poor mother, I ignored her. You know, she was inconsequential. She fed you. She did your clothes. I never had to learn to do any of that stuff. And because that's how it was. And she adored my father, and she was enmeshed with him, and she took care of him. And I thought that's how it was supposed to be. So I went into this marriage and was shocked at violence, broken things, screaming, arrests, bad words, hurt feelings, and I started looking for a way out. And that went on for a long time. Had a couple kids. He didn't want kids. He had two kids already. But I wanted kids, and he said, well, we'll wait 5 years, we'll have kids. So 5 years, you know, I am Al-Anonic. I go by the rules. You know, it always has irritated me. Alcoholics can get away with anything. I mean, you know, they drive their cars, they do all these things, and they don't get caught, or they don't get in trouble a lot of times, you know, and it's like he did anyway. But if I did anything wrong, man, I'm busted, right? So, but anyway, so I wait 5 years. I said, it's 5 years, we're having kids. He's like, eh. I said, well, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to have some kids. If you'd like to be the daddy of them, that'll be fine. So he smashed up the, alcoholic. He smashed up the birth control pills with a hammer. Couldn't just throw them in the garbage. You got to be dramatic. So we had two kids. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, I was bringing two little lives into the world in an alcoholic home with more chaos and more yelling and more screaming. And it was insane. We had an insane life. I didn't know I was insane when I got here. In fact, that really hacked me off when I went to my meetings and they said, well, you're sick and you're crazy. I'm like, he's sick, he's crazy. But no, they said I was. And I slowly began to understand what that meant. We had all kinds of animals at our home. We were looking for, I was looking for something to love me unconditionally, okay? Not because I did what they wanted me to do, not because I fed them dinner, not because I paid the bills, not because all that. I wanted something to just love me unconditionally. We had dogs, cats. We had a billy goat in the yard. We had a toothless horse that he got for the kids. We had mice. We had a bird. We had all this stuff. We had a potbelly pig. I like to never got rid of that pig. Her daddy promised her that pig, and he got it for her, and when we finally ended up apart, I finally had to give it away. I couldn't sell it. In fact, when Phil and I started dating, he came over to the house, and this little pig is running around, and did you know they have hoofs? And it clicked its little hoofs all over the floor as it would run around through the kitchen, and he's like, why don't we go to my house? It was insane. But I didn't think there was anything wrong with me. It was all his fault. I blamed him for everything, too. It was easy to blame him. It was easy to see what was wrong with him. His head fell in the dinner plate. Literally. He got in trouble all the time. He fell on the front porch and smashed his face on the iron railing and passed out. And then the next morning, he gets up and looks in the mirror and goes, what's wrong? What happened to me? So I told him, and he's like, I don't remember that. And I said, liar. Or he'd say to me, well, I didn't say that to you, liar, because I didn't know. He couldn't remember. He was having blackouts. I later found out that I had emotional blackouts. Things would happen. I could remember up to a certain point on a day, and there'd be some kind of chaos. He tore up the apartment. There was stuff on the floor everywhere. He was threatening me. He was violent. I jumped up, I grabbed my purse, I left, I went to some friend's house, I stayed there. I laid on the couch thinking the whole time, I wonder if he's okay. I wonder if he's going to hurt himself. I wonder if he's all right. You know, and I had just run away because I was afraid. But so he found me, of course. He came and he got me. We drove 100 miles an hour all the way across Greensboro, North Carolina, back to our apartment. And we walk in the door and he says, clean up all this mess. I got on my hands and knees, and I started crawling, picking up broken glass and cigarette butts, and I don't remember anything else after that day. And I came to understand that I had an emotional blackout. I just went away. And that's what I did. Mostly I didn't physically run away, although I did leave once or twice and go back. But I mentally ran away. Life wasn't good, and so I just went away. And I had this wonderful fantasy life where I could create a sense of well-being. I could, my heart rate, my respiration, I could get all that just going really nice in la-la land. And then the kids would start screaming, the dog would start barking, somebody's banging on the door, or, you know, you're back to real life. And I felt trapped, and I could not find a way out. I couldn't figure out how to get out of there. I finally divorced him after he wrecked the first new car I ever had. That really made me angry, and because we were broke all the time. I mean, we're talking about rolling quarters and pennies, going to the grocery store with 20 bucks, trying to feed four people for a week. But we had whiskey. We had cigarettes. You know, we had the priority stuff down. So, anyway, I said, I'm sick of you. I hate your guts. I'm getting a divorce. I'm going to solve this problem. You are my problem, and I'm going to get rid of it, and then I'll be okay. And so, not as easy said, done as said, but I did. I got a divorce, and I went looking for Prince Charming, because he obviously wasn't it. And I looked, and I looked, and I couldn't find him. And all this time, he's continuing to say to me, I love you, baby. I can't live without you. I can't live without the kids. I'll never do it again. You know, and I wanted to believe that. And he meant it when he said it, I believe, that he meant it. But he couldn't do it. He either could not or would not. So he quit drinking, miraculously, after we got a divorce. And for about 9 months, and he looked better, smelled better, acted better. So I let him come home, and I married him again. On Saturday morning with a 5-year-old little girl with flowers in her hair. And we went to 7 o'clock to get married so the preacher could go play golf. And I thought it was going to be okay because I didn't know anything about, I didn't really understand alcohol. I didn't know about alcoholism. I didn't know what was going on. 30 days later, he was wasted. And I was terrified. I was embarrassed. I was mortified. How could I do it? How could I believe it? Mostly, I was mad at God. I had my fist in his face. How dare you do this to me? How dare you let me hope? How dare you let me believe? How dare you let me try? How could you? So I was really mad at God. And it took me 7 more years to find you. A long time. But you know what? I was thinking about it this morning. Everything that ever happened to me got me here. Everything that ever happened got me here to you, made me who I am today, with the life I have today, which is really good. I'm a chicken mom. You know, I mean, so I truly do believe that. It was hard to believe at first, you know. I heard these Al-Anons say in the early meetings, I'm so grateful to have an alcoholic in my life. And I thought, you're freaking crazy. But today I understand that. And I really truly do believe that God, even when I had my fist in his face, he loved me enough to bring me to you. And he put me in a meeting with a bunch of people I didn't want to be with. I didn't know. Strangers. Yeah, I didn't even like people. We didn't have friends. You don't have friends over when all this stuff's going on in your house. All I had was work. That's the only place I ever got any strokes. You know, felt good about myself. I was the ultimate little people-pleasing boss's secretary. Lawyers. Good lawyer joke last night, by the way. Right now, I'd just about give anything never to spend another day of my life with lawyers. I'd like to stay home and make art all day. I am an artist. Before I came to you, I couldn't ever say that about myself. You have taught me how to look at me and how to know what I like and what I am and who I am and be what I want to be. And so today I can say things like that. So I finally was able to get a divorce because I came to you and you helped me see that I could choose. I was horrified to learn that I had participated, that I was volunteering, that I was not a victim, because it was easy to blame him, really easy. It was not so easy to let go of that and to say, oh, it's me, and to take responsibility for my own choices. They said, keep coming back, and I did. Since June 17th of 1992, I have never, ever stopped coming back. He went to some meetings, and he got drunk. And he went to treatment, and he got drunk. But I never quit coming back. And so, eventually, through that excruciating process of letting go and coming to believe that God wanted me to be happy and joyous and free, that I could let go and I could walk away, even though I wanted other people to get healthy and happy. I wanted him to get sober. I wanted him to be free. I wanted the children to have a life that could work for them instead of turning them into these little neurotic, crazy people. And that didn't happen. And so eventually I was able to make choices that were better for myself. You know, I so loved the couples that I saw in the program, the Al-Anon and the alcoholic, and he got sober and she went, and they stayed together and they had the 25, 50 years, whatever, you know, worth of, and all that's great, but it doesn't happen that way for everyone. And some people have to make a different choice, and I had to make that for myself. I was dying. I wore black all the time without knowing it. I was in mourning for my life. I had stomach aches, really bad, bad stomach aches. I'd go to a meeting and sit and think I'm going to die if I can't go lay down. My hair fell out in nice big silver dollar size circles. That was a lot of fun. Go to the doctor. Are you under any kind of stress? Would you like for me to explain? Things like that. And it actually got worse before it got better once I came to Al-Anon, because I had to look at me, and I had to start accepting this fact that I participated and that it was my choice, even though I didn't know it. So a very important thing I learned was that I did the best I could with what I had at the time, and I had to accept that. As regards to the children, I later had to come to a place where I was able to acknowledge that the best I could wasn't good enough for them. And yet, still it was the best I could with what I had at the time. And I did what I had to do to save my life, because I was dying. I got down to 89 pounds after I got here. So all in black, 89 pounds, big black circles under my eyes. And I began the process of transforming. In Al-Anon, one of our symbols is the butterfly. And it took me a long time to kind of get a hold of that. I was like, what's the butterfly got to do with anything? And I started to understand. I started to identify with the butterfly. Because when I got here, I was the creepy, crawly little caterpillar, you know, inching, crawling around. Every little rock was a gigantic mountain to get over. A big deal. Everything. Drama, big deal, horrible, life's over, you know, couldn't see the end, couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel. Just this creepy, crawly little thing. But then I came to you, and I began to feel safe. And so I got cocooned in the group, and in the meeting, and with the Al-Anons. And that transformation starts to take place inside of there, inside of me. And I took the 12 steps with my sponsor, and I
they changed me from the inside out. And so eventually that process takes place, the metamorphosis, and the little pod cracks open and out comes these sticky little wings, and then they dry and then they flutter and then you can fly and you're free. You know, they told me that I was powerless over alcohol, and I'm like, I'm not powerless. I don't drink alcohol. And so I had to learn that I was powerless over alcohol. I was. I sniffed for it. I searched for it. I crawled around and crawled up to the couch and smelled him when he was passed out, because he said he wasn't drinking, but I knew he was. So I had to sniff up there and see. You know, I was powerless over alcohol and alcoholics and alcoholism and everything it had done to everybody that I loved, including me. And once I accepted my powerlessness, I became empowered. I became empowered to have a choice to do something different. And I was able to learn to choose what was right for me. My mean old sponsor, this lady that glowed with a light, she was so beautiful, and I wanted what she had. And she told me that I had to do what she did to get it, if I wanted what she had. That's a pretty tall order when you're not sure what that encompasses. So we began to talk, and she told me what I would need to do if I wanted to go through the steps. It was a pretty extensive, I thought, list of requirements. I had to go to so many meetings a week. I need to read this. I need to go here, do that. I needed to go to open AA meetings. Ooh. I don't want to be around alcoholics. All they've ever done is hurt me. You know, that was kind of my attitude. That's okay. She never tried to force me. She never tried. It's a program of attraction, not promotion. If you want what I have, you'll do what I did to get it. So I went. I went to the open AA meeting. And here with these group of wonderful, entertaining, exciting people who welcomed me and got me a chair and a cup of coffee and said, keep coming back. And I was just floored with the love. I was floored with the what I saw before me was all these people seeking to do better, to live better, to be transformed. And so I had fallen in love with Al-Anon, and then I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I kept coming back. And I had my own little home AA group, you know, where I went on every whatever night it was. And I had learned to go to coffee, you know. At first I wouldn't do that for a long time. And then I finally started going for coffee with people. And we'd go out to the Shoney's after the Al-Anon meetings, and we would sit in the rocking chairs at the Cracker Barrel or somewhere like that, sometime 2-3 o'clock in the morning or more. In the wintertime, we would keep blankets in the trunks of our cars so that we could sit out and talk. Because, you know, in the meetings, there's some things you don't say in meetings. But at the after the meeting is a lot of heavy-duty recovery taking place there. And we would cover up with our blankets and rock in the rocking chairs at the Cracker Barrel or the Shoney's outside or wherever and recover. So one night, we're all going out to dinner, and this nice man is sitting next to me, and he's kind of cute, and he's an alcoholic. So here I am in the middle of taking my steps, and so I call up my sponsor, and I said, met this person, and she's like, no, not while you're walking the steps, no. And I said, yeah, but. So she made me bring him for the sponsor interview. So I have to take Phil to meet Sherry, and she takes him in the other room. I cannot even hear what they are saying. And so they're in there for a little, you know, while, and they come back out, and so I get her over here, and I'm like, well? And she said, he's a keeper. You can keep him. I had been to his apartment. He had two plates, two cups, two forks, you know, a rocking chair, a table full of AA literature, big books, 12 and 12s, recovery stuff everywhere, the Spartan bachelor life. And I could see that he was practicing a program. And I had come to a place where I might be willing to trust. I had said to God, because one of my greatest fears was I'd be alone. You know, the rest of my life I'd be alone. If I got rid of this other alcoholic, got rid of, not a very nice way to put it, but I finally was able to divorce him. And, I was terrified. But I didn't want to be alone either. But I had finally said to God, if I have to be alone the rest of my life, to be free, to be happy, to be okay, all right, I give, I'll do it. I'm willing to do it. And then like 2 weeks later, Phil. So now I don't have my fist in his face, but I'm going like, seriously, dude, are you kidding me? And he wasn't kidding me. It was for real. So here's this guy practicing a program. We've started spreading out AA and Al-Anon literature all over the bed and talking and studying and reading and going to a lot of meetings together and conventions together and things like that. In the meantime, there's all kinds of craziness going on. Children had been saying, Mom, you got to get a divorce. We can't live like this anymore. Okay, we did that. So now they're saying, we're going to live with Dad. Really? Lots of bad things happened. Lots of letting go had to take place. Lots of accepting my life as it was and being willing to not worry about what other people said about it. Because the children went to live with their dad. They were comfortable in that neurotic atmosphere. They could do what they wanted to do. In the home with the new recovery going on, there were now, as opposed to before, some disciplines, some structure, some, trying to live a better way. And they did not like that. They rebelled against that. They didn't know what to do with that. So we're going to live with Dad. And they did. They were very angry with me. I went to meetings. I left them when I probably shouldn't have left them. I went to meetings. And he was talking bad, telling them things about me. So, you got the poison going on over here and you're doing what you got to do over here, and it was just not good. Today I have better relationships with my children, and that's the benefits of long time keep coming back, because sooner or later things change, I change. I learned that it's a program of attraction. And if I want my children to ever want what I have, then they need to be attracted to it. And so I learned to not tell them what to do. I learned to let them be who they were. I learned to love them unconditionally and what that meant. My daughter, who threatened to throw me out of a ninth floor apartment window, threatened to strangle the kitty cat, when I was about, maybe 15 years, she was in town and came to the meeting, my birthday meeting, and asked her if she'd like to give me my medallion. And she said, I think I could do that. They went to Alateen, when I made them go before they went to live with them. So they kind of, they knew what was going on. So anyway, she said, I think I could do that. And she got up and made a speech that made grown men cry. Because she said that she was grateful that her mom had come to Al-Anon and that I had been able to love her unconditionally. And not shame her and not, She came to me when she was living with Dad. She called me and said, I need to come see you. Not a good thing when they say it that way. Need to come see you after work. So she shows up and I was fearful, my fear list and my inventory included. I have a teenage daughter, so fear, pregnancy, stuff like that. And so I called my sponsor and I said, I know this is projecting. We try not to project, but I know this is projecting, but I think I know what she's going to tell me. I think she's going to tell me she's pregnant. What do I do? And my sponsor said, well, you don't have to do anything today except listen to her and love her. You don't have to make any boundaries today. You don't have to make any decisions today. Just listen to her and love her. So she came. She had a little bag they give you at the doctor's office with all the baby junk in it. Sure enough, gonna have a baby. She was happy about it. About 3 months or so in, so she had waited to tell me till she thought that it was past time anybody could try to force her to do something she didn't want to do. And she was happy. And she was 14 years old. And so she said, "Mom, I was afraid. I didn't know how you'd react." And I said, "Well, how am I doing?" And she said, "You're doing great." So I learned that from you. I learned that I could love her. I learned that I didn't have to say, "Oh my God, you'll never have your senior prom. You'll never, you know, first date, all the things you might have dreamed of for your little girl to have, you know." All that's changed now. So that's been a long time ago. That little baby is 21 years old now. My daughter now has 5 children total. She lives in Ohio. My son is Adam, and he is 34 years old, just had his first baby in last September. Now they're going to have another one. So we're collecting grandbabies all over the place. Philip has a son who he has 2 children in California and another one in Texas. So, you know, life goes on. Dysfunctional families continue to propagate. And the big kids, there's issues. They've all grown up. My kids grew up, and their kids are growing up in dysfunctional family homes. But you know what? The only thing that I can do is live this life the best I can live it, so they see that there is a way out. And if they want it, they know where it is. I wanted to take, you know, those old-timey drills that do like this, if you put it down on something, I wanted one of those so bad, because I wanted to just put it on top of their little heads and just drill little holes right and pour it right in there. I could not make anybody want. I tried to make my mother go to Al-Anon. She needed to. But you know what? She was afraid it would make her want to leave my daddy. And she wasn't going to do that. She knew she wasn't going to do that. So my sweet daddy got sick. He finally admitted he was an alcoholic. He actually said those words. "And I'll go to AA when I retire." Okay. I knew it for sure. I mean, I knew it already, but I knew it for sure when we went for a visit and there was a cooler next to his recliner in the living room. I'm like, "What is this deal with the recliner?" And there was a beer in there, so we didn't have to walk 15 feet to the kitchen over here. Like, oh my gosh. So he was going to retire. We'd go to AA when he retired. I thought, well, that'll be great. He'll be such a good AA if he can ever get there, you know. And then he got sick, and he had lung cancer, and he died. Before any of that happened, I had already been through the steps, and I had already made amends to my father. And he cried that day, and he said, "Girl, you don't owe me any amends." But I did. I did. And I had done that. And I was so glad I had done that. I was so glad I had already done that. So I didn't have to do it, you know, before it's too late kind of thing. I had a stepson that had, he was murdered. And I had made amends to him before that happened. You know, there's so many good things that happen from living this life of recovery. Things that I learned to do by going through that process of step taking, the self-examination, the making things right with other people. I learned about how I do that for me because I want to be free. We had a meeting the other night on forgiveness and resentments, you know, and why we want to get rid of that. It's for us, you know. It's great. Forgive somebody else if they're happy about it. Good. You know, even better. But if it's just for me, that's why I do it, so I can live, so I can look in the mirror, so I can be okay. Things have happened that I never thought would happen. Phil and I bought after we'd lived in our little tiny 700 square foot apartment in his apartment building where he lived for a long time when we first got married, we finally bought a house back in 1998. And that was just a big, big deal. I had never thought. I had to overcome all the self-limiting thinking that I had had. Because, I mean, I was, I didn't think I could do things. I mean, I had chosen badly from the get-go as a, you know, grown-up. And I just didn't think I could do things. But we actually were able to, and we bought a house, and it was great, and we had great fun fixing it up, and we lived on this little lake, and there were ducks and geese, and, you know, he builds things, so he added on. We just had all this. It was wonderful. And so then a couple of years ago, we decided we wanted to get a little farther away from Memphis. So we started looking for a place in the country. And it took us like 2 years to find, you know, the place. And we ended up with the Lambstead. And so now I'm a chicken mom. And he's a chicken dad. He takes care of them more than I do. We have bunny rabbits, and we have, so I'm back to the, all the animals thing. But you know what? I'm not looking for those animals to love me unconditionally anymore. I already have that. I had to stop trying to make love where it wasn't and see it, find it, receive it where it was. And that was from you guys. And so here's this guy. My sponsor's already proven him, that I could keep him. And, you know, I was sitting in a meeting with him when I knew for sure. In that open AA meeting, across the table, across the room, in fact, that night, he was sitting there, and I don't remember what the topic was, but when it came his turn to share, he said, "I have everything I need. Two plates, two cups, a rocking chair." And that didn't include me then. I have everything I need. But I'd seen all that, and I knew right then that I loved him. He didn't need me. I had been needed to death, you know, darn near to death. But he didn't need me. And we were being together by choice, and I just knew it was going to be okay. And so he asked me to marry him, and I said yes. And everybody, my family, you know, was going, what? Because they knew he was an alcoholic. You know, put recovering in front of alcoholic, it's a whole nother ball game. And so we decided we would get married, and we had our rings, and we had a marriage license, and we had picked out a date, which was a year from our first date kind of date. And the only thing we hadn't done was a preacher or a church or some way to make it happen, right? So we started making some phone calls. Where can we find our local AA judge? And he had married this couple that was a friend of ours, so we called them up, what's Bob's number? And so they didn't have his phone number, but they said, but you can find him at his meeting. Okay, and he'll be 15 minutes late. You have anybody that's at your meeting that's always late? He was it. And so they said, he'll be there, but he'll be late. So we pack up our little stuff, and we go to this meeting for the very first time. Had never been there before, open AA meeting on a Friday night. The group's name was High Anxiety. Not bad for two people who are about to hitch. They're sort of freaking out about it, but also happy. So we go there, and sure enough, there was a girl I went to high school there. I hadn't seen her in all those years. And I said, she said, what are y'all doing here? But we, the meeting was about to get underway, so we couldn't have a chat. And so at the end of the meeting, the chairperson said, does anyone have a burning desire? And she says, I do. I want to know what they're doing here. You know, God is so good. He just sets things up all the time so perfectly. I want to know what they're doing here. And Phil's elbowing me, and I'm elbowing him. And so I said, well, okay, we'd like to get married. And they said, oh, that's so, those were like six people in this. And I said, they said, oh, that's so cute. When are y'all planning on doing that? And we said, how about right now? And Bob said, do you have your license? Yes, sir. Do the chips. I'll be right back. We do the chips. He goes out to his car to get his little book that he carries around because, you know, you never know when two nuts might want to get married at AA meeting. He comes back in. We had the Lord's Prayer, and we had a wedding. didn't know any of these people there except for him.
Phil used to get drunk with him back in the old days. And one guy told us later, he went home and told his wife, "You are never going to believe what happened at the meeting tonight." And then we did what all good AAs and Al-Anons do after a meeting. We went to the Shawnees to be with the rest of our friends. They're like, "You did it. You did it." Yes, we did do it. And that's been since 1995. So we've had a long time of living together. It is challenging being in relationships. People are complicated, and life is complicated, and things happen. But because we have programs of recovery, I have my program, he has his program, but we have a we program. You know, I've heard people say never the two shall meet, but they meet and they interact and they intersect. And because we are able to do that, we have worked through difficulties that all people have. We have overcome things. We have families. We have, you know, I am so grateful that I have taken the 12 steps like my sponsor taught me to do. They are the medicine for what ails me. I can get the prescription written out by the doctor. I can hold it in my little hand. It's not going to do any good unless I do something with it. I can go to the pharmacy. I can get it filled. I can have the little bottle sitting here. Got the medicine in there. But unless I take that inside of myself and allow it to do its magic and change me, it's not going to do any good. And so I'm so glad I did that, because you know what? Life keeps happening to me. I don't know about you, but just because I don't marry to a drunk person anymore, or just because my dad's not dying right at the moment, or just because my kid's not having a baby when she's 14 right at the moment, life keeps happening to me. People are, unless I want to live totally isolated from the rest of the world, I got to have a way to live, because I didn't do it naturally. I used to work with a girl that had a natural program. I'm like, how do you know that? How do you know? You know, because she didn't go to a program. She just naturally knew how to live, but I didn't. So I'm so grateful that I had that. I'm so grateful that you all invited me to be a part of you. I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous gave what they had to the Al-Anon so that we could have a program of recovery. You know, I've heard Al-Anons, I've heard people refer to, oh, here's the little Al-Anon over here, and that person never been in a meeting in their life. That's not an Al-Anon. That's a potential Al-Anon, okay? And so I'm so grateful that I came here and became a real Al-Anon who has a program of recovery that allows me to live, that allows me to love, that allows me to choose, that allows me to be in acceptance. Do I do that perfectly all the time? No. I struggle. That's why I have to keep coming back. I'm going probably to fewer meetings than I have in a long, long time, because moving and, you know, trying to get things situated, but still have, only time I think I ever went a full solid 7 days or so without a meeting was when I had broken my leg and had a pulmonary embolism and was supposed to be dead. And so, recovered from all of that and grateful to be alive, even though when that happened, I saw this bright light in the sky from the chopper where they sent me from one hospital to the other. And every time I'd blink, I'd see this bright light. And I thought, well, that's weird, you know. And when I'd open my eyes, it wouldn't be there. But when I'd blink and I'd see this bright light, and then I'm like, okay, God, I get it. I see you. I get it. You know, and sometimes I caught myself thinking, I almost made it out alive. Because they said I shouldn't have been here. That kind of sounds like a negative thing, but I don't really think it is. You know, because I think that if I die today, if I drop dead right here, right now, I will have known what it means to be happy. I will have known what it means to be free. I will have known what it means to love unconditionally and be loved unconditionally. And that's a pretty good deal. So if I'm out of here today, I'm good. Y'all just sing that Fly to You Know Who song and I'll be all right. And thank you for letting me be here and be part of you and love you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.